everybody. If you don't know me, my name is Vanessa. And I'm going to talk tonight about a topic that I'll just call Jesus and the Inherited right now. It's different than what is in your program because I was reading 1 Peter the last 2 weeks and I just felt like I wanted to talk about something that I was currently learning. So this is very much in process, what I'm learning. One of the main things that stood out to me about 1 Peter is this idea of inheritance. And I know that word from growing up, but it just doesn't, I didn't totally understand what it meant. And as I read the rest of 1 Peter, I felt like there were a lot of great things to say about how to live out of our true selves in light of this inheritance. So that's what I'll be talking about tonight. I didn't know anything about 1 Peter when I started reading it. Now I do, so I'll tell you a little bit about it. So you know how there's letters in the end of the New Testament? Some of you already know this. So there's a bunch of letters. I thought they were all written by Paul. I never thought, well, why is it called Peter and Jude and James and Hebrews and stuff like that? So there's two kinds of letters. There are the letters from Paul, and then there's letters called general epistles, and those are letters that are not written by Paul, and they're not written to just a specific church like the Corinthians. They're written to like a bunch of different churches, a letter that got passed around to churches in a different area. So 1 Peter is one of those, 1 and 2 Peter is one of those general epistles, not written by Paul, and written not to one church, but to a bunch of different churches that were all struggling with one thing. And it's, for a long time, it was assumed that Peter wrote it. It still seems to me that Peter wrote it. He identifies himself as writing it. So the assumption is that he wrote it right before his martyrdom in 64 AD. But the people who don't think it was written by Peter don't think so because it's very sophisticated in style and he was just a fisherman, as you know. So some people think he couldn't have written it. And so someone might have written it in his name, kind of like a biography or something. So I don't know who wrote it, but for tonight I'm just going to say Peter wrote it since that's easier. And who it was written to, this is the first verse that says who these two letters were written to. It was written to aliens. And they lived in these sections of Asia Minor. So Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. And the order of that might be that that's how the letter got circulated, was from that one to the next. So he describes these people that he's writing to as aliens. And there's a few reasons why they might be called aliens. One might be that they literally didn't grow up in the areas that they were at. So they just like weren't in their hometown. That's one possibility. Another possibility that they felt like aliens, these people, is because they were not part of the Roman Empire. In that, Asia Minor is part of the Roman Empire. And the people he's writing to are all thought to be Gentiles who converted to Christianity. So this is not too long after Jesus. And these people all converted to Christianity and are living in the Roman Empire, who is very suspicious of this whole Christian movement and of all these little churches and what they're doing. So there is a lot of persecution for these churches in Asia Minor because it's not cool what they're doing. Even the fact that Peter dies not long after writing this as a martyr shows like the kind of climate that these people were in. Another reason they might be called aliens, the people this is written to, is not only because they're not part of the Roman culture, it might also be because they're not Jews, that they weren't born Jews. So if you know about the Old Testament, a lot of what the Old Testament is about is how God chose this Hebrew people, this certain clan to have a relationship with. And then what Jesus later explains, which I don't know how it works, but Jesus later basically says what was available with Yahweh to the Israelites is now available to the whole world through me. So somehow Jesus chose something in order to open, or God chose something in order to open it up to everybody. But still, now we're fine with that because most of us weren't born Jewish. And it's been years of Gentiles being allowed to be Christians. But these people might be a little bit more self-conscious about that, that, you know, it might feel like it's not rightfully theirs to be Christians. So they might feel alienated even among other Christians, like that they got in through the back door or something. That might be the climate that they experience. So one thing about the people in First Peter is that their heritage definitely is kind of in question. They're not quite too sure like where they stand, not only in their own culture, which wants to persecute them, but also just in the Christian culture. So before I read about it, a few things I want to say to maybe relate to some of the things in First Peter a little bit is whether or not we can see ourselves as aliens or not. Sometimes we sing songs that just assume that, and I've never really thought about it before, because for one, we're just not persecuted for being Christians, at least in the same way that they were here in Philadelphia in America. Some people are, if they take like a prophetic stance like that. So I don't experience being an alien in that way, that, you know, I walk around and people are like, what are you doing? Because they don't even know, you know, I'm not that obvious. But something that is confusing for me and for us in a way that I think they were confused is that things are different now with Christianity. It originally was a religion of the poor and oppressed, and it was something that people were persecuted for. And now it's all confusing because now some of the most powerful and dominant people of the world call themselves Christian. Like, it's even part of our campaign speeches, you know, if you want it to be, to call yourself Christian. So I think that's very confusing, because in a way it makes me wonder, like, am I the same kind of Christian they were? And what does Christian even mean now? Is it what I hear on the TV ads? Is it what people that ask me at work, like, oh my gosh, you're not a Christian, are you? Am I what they think I am? So I feel some alienation in that way, that even within the Christian heritage, I'm a little unsure of where we're at right now and what it actually means to be a Christian. I even know some people who don't use the word Christian. They say they're a Christ follower, because being a Christian has such a so many connotations. So that's one way that I just relate with being in the confusing spot that this audience is in. It's just not quite knowing what it means to have an inheritance and what my heritage is as a Christian. Another thing about First Peter that I just want to say before reading this is that the book wasn't that satisfying for me to read, partly because there's a lot of language in it that I just grew up hearing, so it didn't feel like a very new book to me, the way that Hebrews did when I read it earlier. Two words that kind of threw me off for a while that are going to be said tonight are inheritance and imperishable. And some reasons why I don't like those words partly is because they're just not very much part of our vocabulary. You know, we don't talk about what is perishable, and that's talking about like food items to bring to something. And you don't use the word imperishable anymore. And inheritance doesn't have as much meaning to me now as it probably did to people back then, or to a lot of other people in the world. Like, my inheritance from my grandma is going to be like weird earrings. And she tells me that all the time. And I just can't wait for my inheritance, because it's just, you know, we get to each pick like the weirdest earrings. So inheritance just doesn't have like very much weight to me. So that's just two things that are hard for me about this book. Another one, though, is that there's a fly that I know that it's probably going to be in my mouth at some point. That the idea of inheritance has been used in the past, or maybe in your present, as a way to talk about Christianity as an otherworldly type of religion. Like, have you heard that version of Christianity taught, or maybe you've even felt like it before, where you just think, you know, like, grin and bear it while on earth, store up your treasure in heaven, your inheritance in heaven, and then everything is going to be okay. Which I grew up with some of that in my like repertoire for Christianity, that, you know, this is just a pretty evil place and the body's corrupt. So if you can only wait to get to heaven, things will make sense for everyone, which isn't very good news for the masses of people in the world that are hoping that what Jesus has to say is relevant for life now and that Jesus offers some redemptive way to experience life and to suffer. So if we're only waiting for heaven and only singing things like, you know, you can take all the world, but give me Jesus, that doesn't mean very much to a lot of people. And it doesn't mean very much to me now either, now that I feel like I've experienced suffering where I need Jesus to inform me about how to live now. So that's just a little bit before now this opening verse from 1 Peter. I'll just read this. So this is in the very beginning of the book. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And this is the part that kind of captures the rest of the book. To obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. So I read that in the beginning, and then for the rest of the book, I basically made a list of every time that this idea is used, and so much of the book is talking about what is precious, what is perishable, and what is imperishable. So Peter's writing these people that are really unsure about how to live in persecution and just in their own faith, and the way that he decides to do that is by saying, let me teach you what is precious, what's worth giving your time and energy to, and what does not last. So that's why he uses this language of inheritance. I tried to figure out how our inheritance in God works, and I came up to the conclusion that I just don't really know how it works. So that is probably another talk, maybe for somebody else. Jesus is described as the true heir and as the Son of God. So there's something there about Jesus being the Son of God and then Jesus offering to all of us what was rightfully Jesus's. There's something there about our inheritance. But for tonight, I'm not going to talk about how it works since I'm not quite sure of that. And maybe you can talk about it in yourselves if you do have an idea. But there's a few things I think about when I think of inheritance and what that might mean for us now. One is that I think one way we could see inheritance is our true self, that our true self is our inheritance. If I had to pick one definition for true self, it would be what's found in Colossians. And it's said, as elsewhere in the New Testament too, it says that our life is hidden with Christ in God. And that to me is the best definition of our identity, that who we really are is hidden with Christ in God. And there's something about that definition of true self, which sounds like this imperishable inheritance, that something that is hidden and cannot be faded, cannot be defiled, is something that is hidden with Christ forever in God. So that's one way that I think of inheritance. Another way I think of it is that story of the pearl of great price. Do you know that story where it's a parable that Jesus uses, and he says that there's a man who finds this field, and in it he discovers this pearl of great price, and so the man sells everything he has in order to purchase it. And growing up, I assumed that the pearl of great price was Jesus, and that my life was meant to be a process of selling everything I have in order to obtain Jesus, which totally might be one of the translations of that. Several years ago, I kind of had an experience that changed what I thought of that story. I was going through a really hard time where I wasn't doing very well. So in other words, I wasn't doing a good job to obtain this pearl at all, I didn't think. I just kept failing and failing and felt like I was floundering. And I had this experience where a few people gave me things that reinforced what I'm about to say, which is that I realized that I'm the pearl of great price that Jesus sold everything for to purchase. And after I realized this, like a really dramatic night in college when I'm crying and, you know, someone had slipped a note under my door with that verse on it, knowing that I had broken up with my boyfriend and, not Stephen, I would say it was Stephen, and, was just doing really badly. And then like a week later in the mail, got a pearl necklace from my dad that's on the inside said, "You are the pearl." So if that is not a message from God, I don't know what is. So that's, I was like, that's the pearl of great price. I think maybe they might both be true. Now, I wonder what the pearl of great price is for me now. Because that's kind of when I got saved again as an adult. When I was like, okay, I will not deny this. Like, you saved me. You sold everything you had. I'm that precious to you. That will change my life. It has changed my life. Now I think, okay, what is the pearl of great price to me now? Which sometimes parables can do that. They keep, like, growing. That's why they're not, like, true-false questions. Now I think that the pearl of great price might be my faith. And that might just be the stage of life I'm in. But I really do think that my faith is the most precious thing that I have. Like, when people ask what you do for a living, you know, and I tell them, sometimes I want to say, what I do for a living is I have faith. And I've worked, if I take like two breaths, I might stop. I've worked so hard to have that faith, and I'm going to keep working at it, and it's very precious to me. Like, you can tell me, like, how I'm wrong or what I should and shouldn't do or something like that, but what you cannot take away from me is my faith, no matter what. I mean, I might sometimes have that fight with God where I say, like, I don't feel you and I don't see you, but that's still me having my faith with God. So that, I think, might be the most precious thing right now, the pearl of great price to me, might be that. And I wonder what it will be, you know, in 20 years. It probably will change to something else, something more, like, open and mature or something. I didn't mean that funny. It's just true. Okay. But getting back to inheritance. The only reason why I had that rabbit trail with the pearl of great price is because pearl and inheritance just seem like they're something going on there. You know, like, from my grandma, I will get pearls or something like that as an inheritance. So it's just, it was kind of a connection to me, like, okay, what is my inheritance? It's something like this pearl of great price. But a great thing that happened that is kind of like a God coincidence, or maybe you call those miracles, is that last weekend in the Poconos, I chose to read this book, Jesus and the Disinherited. While I was thinking about inheritance, never put together that the title was Disinherited until Stephen pointed it out to me. So this book is really amazing. It's by Howard Thurman, and basically he writes it for people who are the disinherited. And the definition for disinherited in the dictionary is if you're deprived of your rightful heritage. So something about the way you're treated or what you're born into deprives you of your rightful heritage. Howard Thurman says the disinherited are the people with their backs against the wall. That's how he describes them, which is such a great picture. It means that, you know, you're pinned or you're stuck and there's some threat. And he calls that disinherited because the masses of people in this world are born pinned against the wall, where they are deprived of their rightful heritage as humans to live with dignity and to be able to live in love, to be able to get what they need. People are deprived of that rightful heritage and they're pinned. And so you would think that the book is about either telling the powerful, you know, this is what you can do so that's not the situation anymore. Or you would think it's telling the disinherited, let me tell you all about heaven so that you guys can have a hope and that you'll know how to, like, get there, do whatever it takes right now to just get through the situation and then get to heaven and this is how great it will be. That's what I would assume the book's about. What the book actually is about, it's for the disinherited, and it's saying that they can live with dignity and with creativity and with full integrity, even though they have their backs against the wall. Hi, welcome. and Howard Thurman's guide in this book on the disinherited is that Jesus did it. He says Jesus was born with his back against the wall. He was born disinherited, and yet he did not repay evil for evil. He lived in a way that kept his conscience clean, like he lived with full integrity, without succumbing to fear. He didn't lie even to save his life, which he could have. So in that way, he lived completely free. And at first glance, I thought, wow, yeah, this is amazing. So we can live like Jesus, who was disinherited, but still lived with dignity and with freedom. And then I thought, wait, Jesus's life, in one way, is not enviable at all. I mean, he died at 33. And I'm like a little bit on this new wave of like holistic spirituality and everything. So something I think about or have written about before is like how spirituality is good for your health. Because I really believe that, you know, like the reward of spirituality is in this spirituality. But there's always a little voice when I talk like that or think that, that says spirituality is not good for your health. I mean, it depends on how you define health, because not only might it get you literally killed like it did Jesus and Peter and millions of other people, but it will for sure get your false self killed over and over again if it's true spirituality. And I don't think there's any way around that. So it depends what you mean by health, whether it's good for you or not. In another way, of course, Jesus's life is enviable, because the reality is that we all are born into pain and suffering in some way with our backs against the wall. Many people have it, are in a tighter spot than I am because of where they were born, at what time they were born, and who they were born as. That has nothing to do with them. Amiri, in about 10 minutes, I'll open up for questions, so hold on to that. So Jesus being born into that and being able to live with dignity and creativity, even though he lost his life, there is something amazing and freeing about that. So in that way, I do think it's good for your health. And Howard Thurman really challenges about that. He says there is a thing worse than losing your life, and it's losing your integrity as a human. I was like, man. I mean, like a few weeks ago, I talked like about how sometimes you can lie, right? Didn't I say something like that? Like, there's a time not to tell the truth. Don't think about that anymore. Because Howard, I mean, basically he says at all costs, be integral. So the two things I found in 1 Peter that Howard Thurman really agreed with too in this book on being disinherited that I want to go through. These are my last two things. It's just two things Peter says over and over again to these people that don't really know what their inheritance is or what their heritage is and what to do about that. And the two things I heard him saying over and over again is to fear God and to trust God. So I know a lot of us don't like the phrase fear God, but I recently do like it. And I don't know if it's because I think we all do fear. So I think for me now, the rightful place to direct my fear is towards God and not towards other people and not towards myself and what I can do or what I can't do. So here are a few things from 1 Peter. He says, do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. And this was a Circle of Hope daily prayer maybe a month or two ago. And I remember that phrase, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. And that just seemed to me to be a new thing to do. So sometimes when I'm at work at QVC, like when I'm on air selling a pearl or something, if I think of that phrase and I just say it to myself silently, sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, as Lord in your hearts, I really feel like something in me bows down. And when that happens, I feel like whatever was there does get dislodged, which means there was another Lord there. Because you can't sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. You can't. It's like the eyes of your heart kind of looking up. And to do that, something gets pushed out. And usually it's me looking at myself in the monitor, deciding whether I look pretty or not. That's usually what gets dislodged, is all my, like, 99% of my thoughts, which are just about, like, how do I look? What do people think about me? How are they going to treat me? What am I going to eat next? You know, just like repetitive, circular thoughts. And when I sanctify Christ as Lord in my heart, something gets pushed out and something about it feels right. Another one, First Peter, is do what is right without being frightened by any fear, which is so interesting. It doesn't say there will be no fear, but it says to not be frightened by any fear. And that's why what I mean about fear God and not others and not yourself, in that don't give anyone the power in your life that only God should have. Howard Thurman talks a lot about this. He basically says that if you know your true self, if you know you're a child of God, that you'll realize that giving any man or woman power over you in terms of fear, even if they literally do have power over you, that that is a denial of your basic integrity as a person. Because he says what being a child of God does is it gives us a scale of values. If you know that your true identity is hidden with Christ and God, it's you're given the scale of values that forever helps you manage who has power. And the scale of values will keep pointing to fear God. No other person and no other thing in your life that happens can have that place that God has in our lives. And that is just the way it is. And if we do fear other people and we fear ourselves, then it will have a consequence on who we are as people. And the last one, for this finds favor, if for the sake of a conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows. And to me, that's the same thing. If for the sake of a conscience toward God, I think like, okay, in some situations in my life, if I could think of it as for the sake of my conscience towards God, what should I do in this situation? That's the scale of values. That's me saying like, who ultimately has power in my life and how can I act in such a way that honors that? A phrase that Thurman quotes someone else saying, which just captures this part so much, is humility cannot be humiliated. And that's what I think, if you fear God and not others, that kind of humility cannot be humiliated. That's the freedom Jesus had. Even though he died, he did lose his physical life. He gained his life, and he says that to us. Even if we lose our physical life, we gain our life in God. So the last one is to trust God. This is what Peter says like over and over again in this first letter. Therefore, those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. It says entrust yourself several times. Another chapter ends with God is the shepherd and guardian of your souls, which is like, might as well all put that above our beds because that's so beautiful. God is the shepherd and guardian of my soul. God will direct me and will guard my soul. Great. Like, nope, no problem then. And another one, follow in Christ's steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. He did not lie to save his life. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. So Peter's saying, like, it's so many times, if you don't know who you are, and you don't even know how to be a Christian, and you don't know how to deal with the persecution or the deaths of the false self that come along with being a Christian, entrust yourself to God. That's the place where you should put your trust. And two things I think trust means we have to give up on. One thing, trust means we have to give up on certainty and our need for certainty, because that's exactly what trust is. We're not completely certain. That's why it's trust. And I feel like that lust for certainty is like our basic lust. I feel like even Adam and Eve, if that story is real or symbolic or whatever, they wanted to know for sure. They wanted certainty, and that's what they gave into. And God said, that's not how I set it up. You have to be in relationship with me and trust me. So one thing we have to give up is that, like, that need for certainty. And another thing we have to give up is worrying to trust. I used to think worrying is just like a real light, like one of those sins, like if you go to a job interview and they say, like, what are your worst qualities? And you're like, I work too hard, I care too much, and I worry too much about whether everything's going right. And they're like, oh, you're such a good worker. You know, you're such a good person for those to be your sins. I used to think worry was like that. Like, it's kind of good to worry and to make sure everything falls into place and to stay up at night thinking about it. I don't think worry is good for you anymore. I think for sure it is bad for your health. It's not even a question of whether it's good. And one thing Howard Thurman says is that there is a war on nerves going on in the world. And he says that the underprivileged in any society are victims of this perpetual war of nerves, in that they're always threatened with violence and with not being able to get what they need. And he said the horrible part of it, which is so true, is that what they're afraid of doesn't even have to happen for it to wreak its havoc on your soul. And that is so true. I am a big anticipator. Like, if you send me a present before my birthday, I will open it as soon as I get it. Christmas presents, I secretly open them when I get it and tell my family. I don't tell my family that later. You know, I cannot handle the anticipation of it. Yeah, and with eating food, I love food. So at the beginning, when the plate is full, I'm like so happy. As it's getting down to not as full, I just start to get depressed. Like, what? It's gone? It doesn't even feel good anymore because I just want it to be full. The anticipation is over. So that translates into my fear life as well, in that when I'm afraid of something, it really does not even have to happen for it to wreak its havoc on me. It already does something to me to be that anxious. And the person who taught me about that is my mom. And this is something Howard Thurman and I have in common, is that we have amazing moms who did these two things. She feared God alone, and she does. I mean, she fears God alone, and she trusts God. And so I'll tell you a story about my mom and then a story about Howard Thurman's mom. So my mom, this is just like one of the things I remember about her most, is that I was really afraid when I was little. Like, I had anxiety attacks and stuff. And so one thing she would do with me is she would say, what's the worst that can happen? And which is a horrible question, because then you're like, well, like, you walk outside and die and dad tries to save you and he dies. And you're like, thanks for making me like say that out loud. And then the brilliant part is that once you sit through it, you name your greatest fear and you sit through it, and my mom's still right there. She wouldn't say that will never happen. She would just say, okay. And it's like, wait, so that's, maybe it would be okay. Even if the worst thing happened, maybe that would be okay. So when I was old enough, I think I was probably 15, she told me a story about the Israelites. So this is found in Isaiah 30, where she says, you have two options in life, Vanessa. In Isaiah 30, God says to the people, in repentance and rest is your salvation, in quietness and trust is your strength. The people say, no, no thanks. We are afraid. We're going to flee on horses. And God says, okay, well then flee. And they say, okay, I got your point. We'll flee on swift horses. And God says, your pursuers will be swift. Whatever you're trying to run away from is already catching you because you're running away from it. So it says, at the threat of one, like, five people will run. At the threat of five, 1,000 people will run, or something like that. So it's that same threat thing. Like, you're threatened by one person, and you could leave your God. But the next sentence is, but the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion. And so my mom's thing was, in the middle of fear, you have two options. You can either run and try to figure it out and run away from it and fix it or ignore it. Or you can stay and sit through the fear and the anxiety and see if it's not true that God longs to be gracious to you and rises to show you compassion. So that's my mom. It was great teaching on that. Howard Thurman, he tells a story about Halley's Comet and how as a little boy he wasn't able to see it because he had to go to bed too early and all the kids at school got to see it. So he was so jealous. And then one night his mom wakes him up and tells him, like, come on, let's go see it. So they're looking up at Halley's Comet, and he's getting a little bit freaked out. And so this like anxiety about like what could possibly happen to this starts overtaking him. And he says to his mom, "What will happen to us if that comet falls out of the sky?" And then this is what he writes. "My mother's silence was so long that I looked from the comet to her face, and there I beheld something in her countenance that I had only seen once before, when I came into her room and found her in prayer. When she spoke, she said, 'Nothing will happen to us, Howard. God will take care of us.'" And then he writes, "O simple-hearted mother of mine, in one glorious moment, you put your heart on the ultimate affirmation of the human spirit. Many things have I seen since that night. Times without number, I have learned that life is hard as crucible steel. But as the years have unfolded, the majestic power of my mother's glowing words has come back again and again, beating out its rhythmic chant in my own spirit. Here are the faith and the awareness that overcome fear and transform it into the power to strive, to achieve, and not to yield." So I'll just end with that story. We have 5 or 10 minutes if you would like to share anything that you thought of, or a question, or an anecdote, or a lesson you've learned. Mike. Julius and then Amiri.
People
Jeremy Cooper.